jobs, and that's how it got up to 235,000. Construction, we mentioned a warmer February than usual. Construction was the obvious beneficiary. This jumps off the page. The construction industry in February added 58,000 net new jobs. Obviously, construction benefits tremendously in the wintertime when the weather is warmer than usual. And by the way, that 58,000 number, that's the biggest increase in net new construction jobs in almost 10 years. By the way, engineering construction, civil engineering construction was a major factor in that increase in construction payrolls. Manufacturing payrolls increased 28,000. Now, that is the most in that category since August of 2013. So it's been 2.5 years. Make it 3.5 years since we saw a number like that. A big increase in mining and logging payrolls of 9,000. That's 4 months in a row that that figure has been in positive territory. And that 9,000 mining and logging figure is the best since January of 2012. As far as goods producing industries, we saw 95,000 jobs added to payrolls in the goods producing category. And that's the highest number in that category in 17 years, all the way back to March of the year 2000. Whether that is sustainable remains to be seen, because that is a big jump in that 1 month. So we have to see how sustainable that figure turns out to be. Now, in the private services field, there was some weakness. We saw a growth of 132,000 in private services, and adding in the 95,000 that I mentioned in the goods producing, that's how you get the 227,000 private sector payroll growth. You take that 95,000 goods producing industries, you take the 132,000 private services, that gets you to the 227,000 private sector new jobs. Now, as far as the services sector, you know we live in a service economy, very, very highly percentage, a very high percentage in service. And that that service number was soft because over the last 12 months, we've averaged 163,000 private service jobs, but we only had 132,000 in the month of February. Most of that came in professional and business services, where there were 37,000. Education picked up 29,000, healthcare 27,000. So if you add those three together, if you add together the professional and business services, the education, and the healthcare, you get 93,000 of that 132,000 in the private services sector. Retail was hit pretty hard. You know, retail's been struggling, and especially brick-and-mortar retail, struggling mightily. And retail payrolls declined 26,000 in the month of February. That's the most since the end of the year 2012. A lot of cuts in general merchandise stores. This includes department stores. This is part of the story that you, I'm sure you're well aware of, where a lot of shopping has shifted online, and a lot of the brick-and-mortar general merchandise stores, that includes department stores, have been feeling the pain of online shopping. And that's why we saw 26,000 retail payroll jobs lost in the month of February. That's just for the 1 month. We continue to see the trend that we have seen, which is a shift toward online operations and away from the traditional brick-and-mortar operations. One of the problems for the general merchandise stores, though, is that even though they are trying to move in the direction of online operations, They're stuck with their brick-and-mortar stores. I was noting this week that the retailer that has done the best in terms of switching over to online is Staples. And the last figure I saw for Staples was 55% of sales are online. And that basically is an industry-leading figure for what was a traditional brick-and-mortar operation. 55% of Staples sales reported to be online, but the problem is they're stuck with all of these brick-and-mortar operations, and therefore it becomes very hard for them to compete with an outfit like Amazon.com that is essentially an online operation. And so we'll see where that goes. And as I mentioned, government payrolls increased by 8,000 for the month. That brings up the total figure, 227 plus 8, or 235,000 total new jobs for the month of February. Now, the average work week is still 34.4 hours. We saw a pickup in hourly earnings of 0.2%, and we saw aggregate payrolls, which includes payrolls, hours, and earnings, get to a 4.3% annual rate of increase. And by the way, that figure, 4.3% for aggregate payrolls, which is the whole ball of wax, that's right in the middle of the range over the past 6 years. So all of this coming out in the Labor Department on Friday, which is the benchmark report on what's going on in the world of employment. Let's get Tom on the line in Saratoga. Tom, welcome to Money Talk.
Hi. Hello, Bob.
Hi.
I'm a long-time Market Times subscriber, and I usually listen to Money Talk on demand, but our golf course is closed for spring maintenance, so I'm calling you live.
That's better than being closed for rain.
Right. Now, I'm basically a Model 3 investor. And my understanding of the way things work today is I have, from the advisor, I get a standard of suitability. In other words, they can only recommend things that are suitable for me. But I only pay on a transaction. So I don't have to pay them the ongoing yearly 1%. Or alternatively, I can pay a 1% and I get this higher fiduciary standard. But since I listen to you and I'm in Model 3, I don't really need that higher standard. And my understanding is the SEC tried to pass a rule that said, well, we want to encourage people to go to this higher fiduciary standard. That is, encourage them to go to pay the 1%. SEC, being bipartisan, couldn't get it passed. So instead, the Labor Department under Obama comes up with a rule, because they're not, they certainly weren't bipartisan, to protect us from just being Model 3 Bob Brinker listeners, and encourage us to go to the 1% fiduciary model. And that if we don't, then the brokers have to go through paperwork, or some of them, just smaller ones, just can't do it. So I guess my question, given all this, is to a Model 3 Bob Brinker listener, why is the fiduciary rule to our benefit?
Well, I think that the underpinning of your argument is false. I do not believe, Tom, and I don't want to believe, by the way, that the government is in the business of trying to force people to pay 1% a year on their entire portfolio to get investment advice. Because if the government were in that business, then they would be ignoring academia. And academia has shown time and time again that one of the best things you can do, which, by the way, is what you're doing by following Model 3 to a large extent, one of the best things you can do is reduce your expenses. Because when you reduce your expenses, that money goes into your pocket and compounds over your investment lifetime. So, A, I do not believe, and B, I certainly don't want to believe that the government will ever be in the business of trying to force investors to pay 1% a year on their investment account to get any kind of advice. I mean, that would be a national disgrace if that were to happen.
Okay, but my point is, I'm not saying we can't do the Bob Brinker 3%, but if they're trying to...
What in the world am I hearing? What is the Bob Brinker 3%? I've never heard of that.
I'm sorry. Model 3, and follow Bob Brinker's advice.
Well, certainly anybody that wishes to do that can do that. Yes, if they subscribe to the newsletter and they choose to do that, and many people do, and that's the way that works out, fine. But they're not paying. Think about it. Yeah, they have a subscription to a newsletter, but they're not paying 1% of the portfolio value for that advice.
Okay, but my understanding of this, when the new rule goes into effect, either you have to pay the 1% and you get this fiduciary standard, or if you don't want to pay the 1%, and I don't, I want to stay with you and Model 3, then the brokerage has to go through some paperwork to protect themselves legally, and a number of brokers are just not going to offer that.
Well, I can tell you this, that first of all, if you're following the investment suggestions of an investment newsletter, which is what I write an investment letter. If you're following the investment suggestions of an investment letter, that is not part of what you're talking about. That is not part of the fiduciary rule, for example. The purpose of the fiduciary rule is, and by the way, you don't have to own the funds. You don't have to own the funds in the Model Portfolio 3, which is a balanced portfolio, by the way, for the uninitiated. You don't have to own the funds in Model 3 through a broker. You can own the funds directly with the funds. You can do business directly with the funds. You don't even have to have a broker. Some people have a broker for convenience, but there's no requirement in the newsletter that you have a broker. We have subscribers that simply own the funds directly with the fund families. They're no-load funds. It's a very low-cost way to own them, and they don't pay a 1% fee or anything like that. Now, the purpose of the fiduciary rule is to encourage, to mandate investment advisors that when they give advice on tax-preferred accounts, IRAs, for example, very commonly IRAs, 401Ks, but very commonly IRAs and rollover accounts, when they give advice on tax-privileged accounts, they are required to put the customer's interest first. And by the way, I've never seen any problem with putting the customer's interest first, and I've never understood the lobbying money that the industry spends to fight rules like this, because I believe that it should be obvious that the customer's interest should always be placed above all other interests, certainly the interests of a broker. And so that's the purpose of the rule. When it comes, first of all, it only applies to tax-privileged money. And second of all, it's to encourage, actually require, an advisor to place the customer's interest first. That's what it's all about.
Okay. But for that, I have to pay the 1%. So if I don't want to pay the 1%...
Well, I don't understand anything about 1%. Let me be very clear. We have investment letter subscribers literally all over the world on several continents. I mean, we're in our 32nd year in the investment letter. I mean, I can tell you, and most of them are in the United States. Now, I can tell you that there is no requirement in the investment letter For people following any of the model portfolios, including the balanced Model 3, there is no requirement that they pay a broker 1% to invest in the funds in the investment letter. That is not true.
No, I understand that's not true, but I'm saying is if they want to get, if when this fiduciary rules goes into place, if you use an advisor, then the advisor is going to want to charge the 1%. So I guess
let me ask a question. Why would somebody investing in the balanced Model 3 in the investment letter, why would somebody investing other than for convenience? I understand people don't want to have anything to do with it. They don't want to do it themselves, and they hire somebody to do it for them. Okay, fine. I understand that. They're too busy or whatever. But somebody like yourself that of your own volition is subscribing to the investment letter, investing in the Model 3 funds, why do you need an advisor?
Oh, I don't, and I won't use one.
Well, I mean, that sums it up right there. I agree with you that if you're following a portfolio and investment letter and it's working for you and it has the kind of history that this portfolio has, going, this portfolio goes back to, I believe, 1990, then, yeah, I agree with you. To pay somebody a percentage of your portfolio, it doesn't really make any sense. And I would say that the vast majority of people following the balanced Model 3 in the investment letter, they don't pay somebody a percentage of their account to do it. They do it themselves. Appreciate the call. This is Money Talk.